You truly have all killed yourselves. Since, as you note, there are no guardians here to take care of the matter for you. Nasun catches herself before she would have started in surprise. Kill themselves? But she's not quite good enough at controlling her orogeny to keep it from twitching where she does not. All three of the Fulcrum people glance at her, and Serpentine smiles thinly. Careful, guardian, she says, looking at Nasun, but speaking to Shafa. Your pet seems uncomfortable with the idea of mass extermination for no reason. Shafa says, I hide nothing from her. And Nasun's surprise is swallowed up by love and pride. He glances at Nasun. Historically, the Fulcrum has survived on the sufferance of its neighbors, depending on the walls and resources of comms nearby. And as with all who have no viable use during a season, there is most certainly an expectation that Imperial Origins will remove themselves from the competition for resources, so that normal, healthy people have a better chance to survive. He pauses. And since Origins are not permitted to exist outside the supervision of a guardian or the Fulcrum, he spreads his hands. We are the Fulcrum Guardian, says the third senior, whose name Nasun has forgotten. This is a man from some western coastal people. He is slender and straight-haired, and has a high-cheekboned, nearly concave face. His skin is white, too, but his eyes are dark and cool. His orogeny feels light and many-layered like mica. And we are self-sufficient, quite apart from being a drain on resources, we provide needed services to the nearby communities. We have even, unasked and uncompensated, worked to mitigate the aftershakes of the rifting on the occasions when they reach this far south. It is because of us that few Antarctic comms have suffered serious harm since the start of this season. Admirable, says Umber, and clever, making yourselves invaluable. Not a thing your guardians would have permitted, though, I imagine. All three of the seniors grow still for a moment. This is Antarctic, guardian, says Serpentine. She smiles, though the expression does not reach her eyes. We are a fraction of the size of the Fulcrum at Numinous. Barely 25 ringed origins, a handful of mostly grown grits. There were never many guardians permanently stationed here. Most of what we got were visiting guardians on circuit or delivering us new grits. None at all since the rifting.
Never many guardians stationed here, agrees Shafa. But there were three, as I recall. I knew one.
He pauses, and for a fleeting instant his expression goes distant and lost, and a little confused.
I remember knowing one.
He blinks, smiles again.
Yet now there are none.
Serpentine is tense. They are all tense, these seniors, in a way that makes the itch at the back of Nasun's mind grow. We endured several raids by calmless bands before we finally put up a wall, Serpentine says. They died bravely, protecting us. It's so blatant a lie that Nasun stares at her, mouth open.
Well,
Shafa says, setting down his cup of safe and letting out a little sigh.
I suppose this went about as well as could be expected.
And even though Nasun has guessed by now what is coming, even though she has seen Shafa move with a speed that is not humanly possible before, even though the silver within him and Umber ignites like match flame and blazes through them in the instant just before, she is still caught off guard when Shafa lunges forward and puts his fist through Serpentine's face. Serpentine's orogeny dies as she does, but the other two seniors are up and moving in the next instant, Lamprofire falling backward over his chair to escape Umber's blurring reach for him, and the six-ringed woman drawing a blowgun from one sleeve. Shafa's eyes widen, but his hand is still stuck in Serpentine.
He tries to lunge at her, but the corpse's dead weight on his arm. She lifts the gun to her lips. Before she can get off a puff, Nasun is up and in the earth and beginning to spin a torus that will ice the woman in an instant. The woman jerks in surprise and flexes something that shatters Nasun's torus before it can form completely. It is a thing her mother used to do during their practices if Nasun did something she wasn't supposed to. The shock of this realization causes Nasun to stagger and stumble back. Her mother learned that trick here in the Fulcrum. This is how people from the Fulcrum train young origins. Everything Nasun has known of her mother is tainted by this place and always has been. But the fleeting distraction is enough. Shafa rips his hand free of the corpse at last and is across the room in another breath, grabbing the blowgun and snatching it away and stabbing it into the woman's throat before she can recover. She falls to her knees, choking, reaching instinctively for the earth, but then something sweeps the room in a wave, and Nasun gasps when suddenly she cannot cess a single thing. The woman gasps too, then wheezes, scrabbling at her throat. Shafa grabs her head and breaks her neck with a swift jerk. Lamprafire is scrambling backward as Umber stalks him, fumbling at his clothing where some kind of small, heavy object has gotten lodged in cloth. "Evil earth," he blurts, jerking at the buttons of his jacket. "You're contaminated, both of you!" He gets no further, though, because Umber blurs, and Nasun flinches as something splatters her cheek. Umber has stomped the man's head in. "Nasun?" Shafa says, releasing the six-ringed woman's body and staring down at it. "Go to the terrace and wait for us there."
"Yes, Shafa," Nasun says.
She swallows. She's shaking. She makes herself turn despite this and walk out of the room. There are approximately 22 other ringed origins around somewhere, after all, Serpentine said. The Antarctic Fulcrum isn't much bigger than the town of Jekity. Nasun is leaving the big, two-story house that serves as the administrative building. There's also a cluster of tiny cottages that apparently the older origins live in, and several long barracks near the big glass-walled greenhouse. Lots of people are around, moving in and out of the barracks and cottages. Few of them wear black, even though some of the civilian-dressed ones feel like origins. Beyond the greenhouse is a sloping terrace that hosts a number of small garden plots, too many altogether to really qualify as gardens. This is a farm. Most of the plots are planted heavily with grains and vegetables, and there are a number of people out working on them since it's a nice day. And no one knows the guardians are busily killing everyone in the admin building. Nasun walks the cobbled path above the terrace briskly, with her head down so that she can concentrate on not stumbling, since she can't cess anything after whatever Shafa did to the six-ringed woman. She's always known that guardians can shut down orogeny, but never felt it before. It's hard to walk when she can only perceive the ground through her eyes and feet, and also when she's shaking so hard. Carefully, she puts one foot in front of the other, and suddenly someone else's feet are just there, and Nasun pulls up short, her whole body going rigid with shock.
"Watch where you're going,"
the girl says reflexively. She's thin and white, though with a shock of slate-gray ash-blow hair, and she's maybe Nasun's age. She stops, though, when she gets a good look at Nasun.
"Hey. There's something on your face.
It looks like a dead bug or something. Gross." She reaches up and flicks it off with one finger. Nasun jerks a little in surprise, then remembers her manners.
"Thanks. Sorry for getting in your way."
"It's all right." The girl blinks. "They said some guardians had come and brought a new grit. Are you the new one?" Nasun stares in confusion.
Grit?
The other girl's eyebrows rise.
"Yeah. Trainee.
Imperial origin to be." She's carrying a bucket of gardening supplies,
which doesn't fit the conversation at all. The guardians used to bring kids here before the season started. That's how I got here. Technically, that's how Nasun got here, too.
The guardians brought me, she echoes. She is hollow inside.
Me too. The girl sobers, then looks away.
Did they break your hand yet?
Nasun's breath stops in her throat. At her silence, the girl's expression turns bitter.
Yeah.
They do it to every grit at some point. Hand bones, or fingers. She shakes her head, then takes a quick, gulping breath.
We're not supposed to talk about it. But it's not you, whatever they say. It's not your fault.
Another quick breath.
I'll see you around. I'm Ajay. I don't have an origin name yet. What's your name?
Nasun can't think. The sound of Shafa's fist crushing bone echoes in her head.
Nasun?
Nice to meet you, Nasun. Ajay nods politely, then moves on, walking down the steps toward a terrace. She hums, swinging her bucket. Nasun stares after her, trying to understand.
Origin name?
Trying not to understand. Did they break your hand yet? This place, this fulcrum, is why her mother broke her hand. Nasun's hand twitches in phantom pain. She sees again the rock in her mother's hand, rising, holding a moment, falling.
Are you sure you can control yourself?
The fulcrum is why her mother never loved her, is why her father does not love her anymore, is why her brother is dead. Nasun watches Ajay wave to a thin older boy who is busy hoeing. This place, these people, who have no right to exist.
The sapphire isn't far off, hovering over Jekedi, where it has been for the 2 weeks since she and Shafa and Umber left to travel to the Antarctic fulcrum. She can sense it in the distance, though it's too far off to see. It seems to flicker as she reaches for it. And for an instant, she marvels that she knows this somehow. Instinctively, she is turned to face it, line of sight. She doesn't need eyes or orogeny to use it. This is an origin's nature, the old Shafa might have told her if he still existed. Nasun's kind innately react to all threats the same way, with utterly devastating counterforce. He would have told her this before breaking her hand to drive home the lesson of control.
There are so many silver threads in this place. The origins are all connected through practice together, shared experience. Did they break your hand? It is over in the span of 3 breaths. Then Nasun lets herself fall out of the watery blue and stands there shaking in its wake. Some while later, Nasun turns and sees Shafa standing in front of her with Umber.
They weren't supposed to be here, she blurts. You said...
Shafa isn't smiling, and he is still in a way that Nasun knows well.
Did you do this to help us then?
Nasun can't think enough to lie. She shakes her head.
This place was wrong, she said. The fulcrum is wrong.
Is it?
It is a test, but Nasun has no idea how to pass it.
Why do you say that?
Mama was wrong. The fulcrum made her that way. She should have been an ally to you.
Like me, she thinks, reminds.
This place made her something else.
She cannot articulate it.
This place made her wrong.
Shafa looks at Umber. Umber tilts his head, and for an instant, there is a flicker in the silver. A flicker between them. The things lodged in their sesapine resonate in a strange way. But then Shafa frowns, and she sees him push back against the silver. It hurts him to do this, but he does it anyway, turning to gaze at her with eyes bright and jaw tight and fresh sweat dotting his brow.
I think you may be right, little one, is all he says. It follows. Put people in a cage, and they will devote themselves to escaping it, not cooperating with those who caged them. What happened here was inevitable, I suppose. He glances at Umber, still. Their guardians must have been very lax to let a group of origins get the drop on them. That one with the blowgun, born feral most likely, and taught things she shouldn't have been before being brought here. She was the impetus. Lax guardians, says Umber, watching Shafa. Yes. Shafa smiles at him. Nasun frowns in confusion. We've destroyed the threat, Shafa says. Most of it, Umber agrees. Shafa acknowledges this with an incline of his head and a faintly ironic air before turning to Nasun. He says, You were right to do what you did, little one. Thank you for helping us. Umber is gazing steadily at Shafa, at the back of Shafa's neck specifically. Shafa suddenly turns to glare back at him, smile gone fixed and body deadly still. After a moment, Umber looks away. Nasun understands then. The silver has gone quiet in Umber, or as quiet as it ever gets in any of the guardians. But the glimmering lines within Shafa are still alive, active, tearing at him. He fights them, though, and is prepared to fight Umber, too, if necessary. For her? Nasun wonders, exults. For her. Then Shafa crouches and cups her face in his hands. Are you well? He asks. His eyes flick toward the sky to the east, the sapphire. Fine, Nasun says, because she is. Connecting with the obelisk was much easier this time, partly because it was not a surprise, and partly because she is growing used to the sudden advent of strangeness in her life. The trick is to let yourself fall into it, and fall at the same speed, and think like a big column of light. Fascinating, he says, and then gets to his feet. Let's go. So they leave the Antarctic fulcrum behind, with new crops greening in its fields and cooling corpses in its administrative building, and a collection of shining multicolored human statues scattered about its gardens and barracks and walls. But in the days that follow, as they walk the road and forest trails between the fulcrum and Jekity, sleeping each night in strangers' barns or around their own fires, Nasun thinks. She has nothing to do but think, after all. Umber and Shafa do not speak to one another, and there is a new tension between them. She understands it enough to take care never to be alone in Umber's presence, which is easy, because Shafa takes care never to let her be. This is not strictly necessary. Nasun thinks that what she did to Aits and the people in the Antarctic fulcrum, she can probably do to Umber. Using an obelisk is not sessing. The silver is not orogeny, and thus not even a guardian is safe from what she can do. She sort of likes that Shafa goes with her to the bathhouse, though, and forgoes sleep. Guardians can do that, apparently, to keep watch over her at night. It feels nice to have someone, anyone, protecting her again. But she thinks. It troubles Nasun that Shafa has damaged himself in the eyes of his fellow guardians by choosing not to kill her. It troubles her more that he suffers, gritting his teeth and pretending that this is another smile, even as she sees the silver flex and burn within him. It never stops doing so now, and he will not let her ease his pain, because this makes her slow and tired the next day. She watches him endure it, and hates the little thing in his head that hurts him so. It gives him power, but what good is power if it comes on a spiked leash? Why, she asks him one night as they camp on a flat, elevated white slab of something that is neither metal nor stone, and which is all that remains of some dead-civ ruin.
There have been some signs of raiders and calmness in the area, and the tiny calm they stayed at the night before warned them to be wary. So the elevation of the slab will at least afford them plenty of advance warning of an attack. Umber is gone, offsetting sneers for their breakfast. Shafa has used the opportunity to lie down on his bedroll while Nasun keeps watch, and she does not want to keep him awake. But she needs to know. Why is that thing in your head?
It was put there when I was very young, he says.
He sounds weary. Fighting the silver for days on end without sleep is taking its toll.
There was no why for me. It was simply the way things had to be.
But Nasun does not want to be annoying by asking why again. Did it have to be? What is it for? He smiles, though his eyes are shut.
We are made to keep the world safe from the dangers of your kind.
I know that, but she shakes her head. Who made you?
Me, specifically.
Shafa opens one eye, then frowns a little.
I don't remember. But in general, guardians are made by other guardians. We are found or bred and given over to warrant for training and alteration.
And who made the guardian before you and the one before that? Who did it first? He is silent for a time, trying to remember, she guesses from his expression. That something is very wrong with Shafa, chiseling holes in his memories and putting fault line heavy pressure on his thoughts, is something Nasun simply accepts. He is what he is, but she needs to know why he is the way he is. And more importantly, she wants to know how to make him better.
I don't know,
he says finally, and she knows he is done with the conversation by the way he exhales and shuts his eyes again.
In the end, the why does not matter, little one. Why are you an origin? Sometimes we must simply accept our lot in life.
Nasun decides to shut up then, and a few moments later, Shafa's body relaxes into sleep for the first time in days. She keeps watch diligently, extending her newly recovered sense of the earth to catch the reverberations of small animals and other moving things in the immediate vicinity. She can sense Umber, too, still moving methodically at the edge of her range as he sets up his snares, and because of him, she weaves the thread of the silver into her web of awareness. He can evade her sensing, but not that. It will catch any calmless, too, should they sneak into arrow or harpoon range. She will not let Shafa be injured as her father was injured. Aside from something heavy and warm that treads along on all fours not far from Umber, probably foraging, there is nothing of concern nearby, nothing
except
something very strange. Something immense? No, its boundaries are small, no bigger than those of a mid-sized rock or a person. But it is directly underneath the white, not stone slab. Under her feet, practically. Barely more than 10 feet down. As if noticing her attention, it moves. This feels like the movement of the world. Involuntarily, Nasun gasps and leans away, even though nothing changes but the gravity around her, and that only a little. The immensity whips away suddenly, as if it senses her scrutiny. It doesn't go far, however, and a moment later, the immensity moves again, up. Nasun blinks and opens her eyes to see a statue standing at the edge of the slab, which was not there before. Nasun is not confused. Once, after all, she wanted to be a lorist. She spent hours listening to tales of stone eaters and the mysteries that surround their existence. This one does not look as she thought it would. In the lorist tales, stone eaters have marble skin and jewel hair. This one is entirely gray, even to the whites of its eyes. He is bare-chested and muscular, and he is smiling. lips drawn back from teeth that are clear and sharp-faceted.
"You're the one who stoned the fulcrum a few days ago," says his chest.
Nasun swallows and glances at Shafa. He's a heavy sleeper, and the Stone Eater didn't speak loudly. If she yells, Shafa will probably wake, but what can a guardian do against such a creature? She isn't even sure she can do anything with the silver. The Stone Eater is a blazing morass of it, swirls and whirls of thread all tangled up inside him. The lore, however, is clear on one thing about Stone Eaters. They do not attack without provocation. So, yes, she says, keeping her voice low. Is that a problem?
Not at all. I wanted only to express my admiration for your work.
His mouth does not move. Why is he smiling so much? Nasun is more certain with every passing breath that the expression is not just a smile.
What is your name, little one?
She bristles at the little one. Why? The Stone Eater steps forward, moving slowly. This sounds like the grind of a millstone and looks as wrong as a moving statue should look. Nasun flinches in revulsion, and he stills.
Why did you stone them?
They were wrong. The Stone Eater steps forward again onto the slab. Nasun half expects the slab to crack or tilt beneath the creature's terrible weight, which she knows is immense. He is a mountain, compacted into the size and shape of a human being. The slab of dead sieve material does not crack, however, and now the creature is close enough for her to see the fine detailing of his individual hair strands.
You were wrong, he says in his strange, echoing voice. The people of the Fulcrum and the Guardians are not to blame for the things they do. You wanted to know why your guardian must suffer as he does. The answer is, he doesn't have to.
Nasun stiffens. Before she can demand to know more, the Stone Eater's head turns toward him. There is a flicker of something, an adjustment too infinitely fine to see or sense, and suddenly, the alive, vicious throb of silver within Shafa dies into silence. Only that dark, needle-like blot in his sesapine remains active, and immediately Nasun ceases its effort to reassert control. For the moment, though, Shafa exhales softly and relaxes further into sleep. The pain that has been grinding at him for days is gone. For now. Nasun gasps, softly. If Shafa has the chance to truly rest at last, she will not destroy it. Instead, she says to the Stone Eater, "How did you do that?"
"I can teach you. I can teach you how to fight his tormentor, his master too, if you wish."
Nasun swallows hard. "Yeah, I wish." She isn't stupid, though. In exchange for what?
Nothing. If you fight his master, then you fight my enemy, too. It will make us allies.
She knows now that the Stone Eater has been lurking nearby, listening in on her, but she doesn't care anymore. To save Shafa? She licks her lips, which taste faintly of sulfur. The ash haze has been getting thicker in recent weeks. Okay. She says,
"What is your name?"
If it's been listening, it knows who she is. This is a gesture toward alliance. Nasun. And you?
I have no name. Or many. Call me what you wish.
He needs a name. Alliances don't work without names, do they? Steel. It's the first thing that pops into her mind. Because he's so gray. Steel? The sense that he does not care lingers.
I will come to you later, Steel says, when we can speak uninterrupted.
An instant later he is gone, into the earth, and the mountain vanishes from her awareness in seconds. A moment later, Umber emerges from the forest around the dead Siv's slab and begins walking up the hill toward her. She is actually glad to see him, even though his gaze sharpens as he draws nearer and sees that Shafa is asleep. He stops 3 paces away, more than close enough for a guardian's speed. "I'll kill you if you try anything," Nasun says, nodding solemnly. "You know that, right? Or if you wake him up." Umber smiles.
"I know you will try."
"I'll try and I'll actually do it." He sighs, and there is a great compassion in his voice.
"You don't even know how dangerous you are. To far, far more than me."
She doesn't, and that bothers her a lot. Umber does not act out of cruelty. If he sees her as a threat, there must be some reason for it. But it doesn't matter. "Shafa wants me alive," she says. "So I live, even if I have to kill you." Umber appears to consider this. She glimpses the quick flicker of the silver within him and knows, suddenly and instinctively, that she is no longer talking to Umber, exactly.
"His master."
Umber says,
"And if Shafa decides you should die?"
"Then I die." That's what the Fulcrum got wrong, she feels certain. They treated the Guardians as enemies, and maybe they once were, like Shafa said. But allies must trust in one another, be vulnerable to one another. Shafa is the only person in the world who loves Nasun, and Nasun will die or kill or remake the world for his sake. Slowly, Umber inclines his head.
"Then I will trust in your love for him," he says.
For an instant there is an echo in his voice, in his body, through the ground, reverberating away so deep.
"For now."
With that, he moves past her and sits down near Shafa, assuming a guard stance himself. Nasun does not understand guardian reasoning, but she's learned one thing about them over the months. They do not bother to lie. If Umber says he will trust Shafa, no. Trust Nasun's love for Shafa, because there is a difference. But if Umber says this has meaning to him, then she can rely on that. So she lies down on her own bedroll and relaxes in spite of everything. She doesn't sleep for some while, though. Nerves, maybe. Night falls. The evening is clear, apart from the faint haze of ash blowing from the north and a few broken, pearled clouds that periodically drift southward along the breeze. The stars come out, winking through the haze, and Nasun stares at them for a long while. She begins to drift, her mind finally relaxing toward sleep, when belatedly she notices that one of the tiny white lights up there is moving in a different direction from the rest downward, sort of, while the other stars march west to east across the sky. Slow. Hard to unsee it now that she's made it out. It's a little bigger and brighter than the rest, too. Strange. Nasun rolls over to turn her back to Umber and sleeps. These things have been down here for an age of the world. Foolish to call them bones. They go to powder when we touch them. But stranger than the bones are the murals. Plants I've never seen. Something that might be a language, but it just looks like shapes and wiggling. And one, a great round white thing amid the stars, hanging over a landscape. Eerie. I didn't like it. I had the black jacket crumble the mural away. Journal of Journeywoman Fogrid Innovator Humanis. Archives of the Janir Licensure, Equatorial East. 16. You meet an old friend again.
I want to keep telling this as I have. In your mind, in your voice. Telling you what to think and know. Do you find this rude? It is, I admit, selfish.
When I speak as just myself, it's difficult to feel like part of you. It is lonelier. Please, let me continue a bit longer.
You stare at the stone eater that has burst forth from the chalcedony chrysalis. It stands hunched and perfectly still, watching you sidelong through the slight heat waver of the air around the split geode. Its hair is, as you remember from that half-real, half-dream moment within the garnet obelisk, a frozen splash. What happens to ashblow hair when a hard gust of wind lifts it up and back? Translucent, whitish, opal now, instead of simply white. But unlike the fleshy form that you grew to know, this stone eater's skin is as black as the night sky once was before the season. What you thought were cracks back then, you now realize are actually white and silver marbling veins. Even the elegant drape of pseudo-clothing wrapped around the body, a simple chitin that hangs off one shoulder, is marbled black. Only the eyes lack the marbling. The white's now matte, smooth darkness. The irises are still ice white. They stand out from the black face, stark and so atavistically disturbing that it actually takes you a moment to realize the face around it is still Hoa's. Hoa. He is older, you see at once. The face is that of a young man and not a boy. Still too wide, with too narrow a mouth, racially nonsensical. You can read anxiety in those frozen features, though, because you learned to read it on a face that was once softer and designed to elicit your compassion. Which was the lie, you ask? It is the only thing you can think to ask.
The lie?
The voice is a man's now. The same voice, but in the tenor range, coming from his chest somewhere. You step into the room. It's still unpleasantly hot, though cooling off quickly. You're sweating anyway. Your human shape or this?
Both have been true at different times.
Ah, yes. Alabaster said all of you were human, once anyway. There is a moment of silence.
Are you human?
At this, you cannot help but laugh once.
Officially?
No.
Never mind what others think. What do you feel yourself to be?
Human.
Then so am I.
He stands steaming between the halves of a giant rock from which he just hatched. Not anymore.
Should I take your word for that? Or listen to what I feel myself to be?
You shake your head, walking as far as you can around the geode. Inside it there is nothing. It's a thin stone shell, bare of crystals or the usual precipitant lining. Probably doesn't qualify as a geode, then. How'd you end up in an obelisk?
Pissed off the wrong rocker.
This surprises you into a laugh, which makes you stop and stare at him. It's an uncomfortable laugh. He's watching you the way he always used to, all eyes and hope. Should it really matter that the eyes are so strange now? I didn't know that could be done, you say. Trapping a stone eater, I mean.
You could do it. It's one of the only ways to stop one of us.
Not kill you, obviously.
No. There's only one way to do that.
Which is? He flicks to face you. This seems instantaneous. Suddenly the statue's pose is completely different. Serene and upright, with one hand raised in invitation, appeal.
Are you planning to kill me, Aeson?
You sigh and shake your head, and extend a hand to touch one of the stone halves out of curiosity.
Don't. It's still too hot for your flesh.
He pauses.
This is how I get clean, without soap.
A day along the side of the road, south of Terimo. a boy who stared at a bar of soap in confusion, then delight. It's still him. You can't shake it off. So you sigh and also let go of the part of yourself that wants to treat him as something else, something frightening, something other. He's Hoa. He wants to eat you, and he tried to help you find your daughter, even though he failed. There's an intimacy in these facts, however strange they are, that means something to you. You fold your arms and pace slowly around the geode and him. His eyes follow. So who kicked your ass? He has regenerated the eyes that were missing and the lower jaw. The limbs that had been torn off are part of him again. There's still blood in the living room, but whatever there had been in your bedroom is now gone, along with a layer of the floor and walls. Stone Eaters are said to have control over the very smallest particles of matter, simple enough to reappropriate one's own detached substance, repurpose unused surplus material. You guess? A dozen or so of my kind. Then, one in particular. That many? They were children to me. How many children would it take to overwhelm you? You were a child. I looked like a child. His voice softens. I only did that for you. There is a greater difference between this Hoa and that Hoa than their states of being. When adult Hoa says things like this, the words have an entirely different texture from when child Hoa said them. You're not certain you like that texture. So you've been off getting into fights all this time, you say, adjusting the subject back toward comfort. There was a stone eater at the flat top. A gray, yes. You didn't think it was possible for a stone eater to look disgruntled, but Hoa does. That one isn't a child. He was the one who defeated me finally, though I managed to escape without too much damage. You marvel for a moment that he thinks having all his limbs and jaw torn off is not much damage. But you're a little glad, too. The gray stone eater hurt Hoa, and you hurt him back. Ephemeral revenge, maybe, but it makes you feel like you look out for your own. Hoa still sounds defensive. It was also unwise for me to face him while clothed in human flesh. It's too damned hot in the room. Mopping sweat from your face, you move into the living room, push aside and tie off the main door curtain so cooler air will circulate in more easily, and sit down at the table. By the time you turn back, Hoa is in the door of your bedroom, framed beautifully by the arch of it. Study of a youth in weary contemplation. Is that why you changed back? To face him? You didn't see the bit of rag that contained his rocks while you were in the bedroom. Maybe it caught fire and is just charred cloth amid the rest. Purpose served. I changed back because it was time. There's that tone of resignation again. He sounded that way when you first realized what he was. Like he knows he's lost something in your eyes and he can't get it back. And he has no choice but to accept that. But he doesn't have to like it. Could have kept that shape only for a limited time. I made a choice to decrease the time and increase the chance you will survive. Oh? Beyond him, in your room, you suddenly notice that the leftover shell of his, egg is melting, sort of. It is dissolving and lightening in color and merging back into the clear material of the crystal, parting around the detritus of your belongings as it rejoins its former substance and solidifies again. You stare at that instead of him for a moment, fascinated, until he says, "They want you dead, Esun." "They?" You blink. "Who?" "Some of my kind. Some merely want to use you. I won't let them." You frown. "Which?"
You won't let them kill me, or you won't let them use me?
Either.
The echoing voice grows sharp suddenly. You remember him crouching, baring his teeth like some feral beast. It occurs to you, with the suddenness of an epiphany, that you haven't seen as many Stone Eaters around lately. Ruby hair, butter marble, ugly dress, tooth shine, all the regulars. Not a glimpse in months. Yika even remarked on the sudden absence of hers.
You ate her, you blurt.
There is a pause.
I've eaten many,
Hoa says. It is inflectionless. You remember him giggling and calling you weird, curling against you to sleep.
Earth fires, you can't deal with this. Why me, Hoa?
You spread your hands. They are ordinary, middle-aged woman hands, a bit dry. You helped with the leather tanning crew a few days ago, and the solution made your skin crack and peel. You've been rubbing them with some of the nuts you got in the previous week's calm share, even though fat is precious and you should be eating it rather than using it for your vanity. In your right palm, there is a small, white, thumbnail-shaped crescent. On cold days, that hand's bones ache. Ordinary woman hands.
There's nothing special about me, you say. There must be other origins with the potential to access the obelisks. Earth fires. Nasun.
No.
Why are you here?
You mean, why has he attached himself to you? He is silent for a moment. Then,
you asked if I was all right.
This makes no sense for a moment, and then it does. Alia. A beautiful sunny day, a looming disaster. As you hovered in agony amid the cracked, dissonant core of the garnet obelisk, you saw him for the first time. How long had he been in that thing? Long enough for it to be buried beneath seasons worth of sediment and coral growth? Long enough to be forgotten like all the dead civilizations of the world? And then you came along and asked how he was doing. Evil Earth? You thought you hallucinated that. You take a deep breath and get up, going to the entrance of the apartment. The calm is quiet as far as you can tell. Some people are going about their usual business, but there are fewer of them around than usual. The ones following routine are no proof of peace. People went about their business in Torimo, too, right before they tried to kill you. Tonki didn't come home again last night, but this time you're not so sure that she's with Hjarka or up in the green room. There is a catalyst alive in Kastrima now, accelerating unseen chemical reactions, facilitating unexpected outcomes. Join us and live, the Grey One had told them. But not with your ragas. Will the people of Kastrima stop to think that no equatorial calm really wants a sudden influx of mongrel mid-ladders, and at best will make slaves or meat of them? Your mothering instinct is alive with warning. Look after your own, it whispers in the back of your mind. Gather them close and guard them well. You know what happens when you turn your back for even a minute. You shoulder the runny sack that's still in your hand. Keeping it with you isn't even a question at this point. Then you turn to Hoa. Come with me. Hoa's suddenly smiling again.
I don't walk anymore, Esun.
Oh, right. I'm going to Yika's, then. Meet me there. He does not nod, simply vanishes. No wasted movement. You'll get used to it. People don't look at you as you cross the bridges and walkways of the calm. The center of your back itches from their stares as you pass. You cannot help thinking of Torimo again. Yika's not in her apartment. You look around, follow the patterns of movement in the calm with your eyes, and finally head toward the flat top. She cannot still be there. You've gone home, watched a child turn into a stone eater, slept several hours. She can't be. She is. You see that only a few people are still on the flat top now, a gaggle of maybe 20 sitting or pacing, looking angry and exasperated and troubled. For the 20 you see, there are surely another 100 gathering in apartments and the baths and the storage rooms, having the same conversation in hushed tones with small groups. But Yika is here, sitting on one of the divans that someone has brought from her apartment, still talking. She's hoarse, you realize as you draw close. Visibly exhausted, but still talking. Something about supply lines from one of the southern allied comms, which she's directing at a man who is walking in circles with his arms folded, scoffing at everything she says. It's fear. He's not listening. Yika's trying to reason with him anyway. It's ridiculous. Look after your own. You step around people, some of whom flinch away from you, and stop beside her. I need to talk to you in private. Yika stops mid-sentence and blinks up at you. Her eyes are red and sticky dry. She hasn't had any water for a while. What about? It's important. As a sop to courtesy, you nod to the people sitting around her. Sorry. She sighs and rubs her eyes, which just makes them redder. Fine. She gets up, then pauses to face the remaining people. Votes tomorrow morning. If I haven't convinced you? Well, you know what to do then. They watch in silence as you lead her away. Back in her apartment, you pull the front curtain shut and open the one that leads into her private rooms. Not much to this space to indicate her status. She's got two pallets and a lot of pillows, but her clothes are just in a basket, and the books and scrolls on one side of the room are just stacked on the floor. No bookcases, no dresser. The food from her comm share is stacked haphazardly against one wall, beside a familiar gourd that the Castremans tend to use for storing drinking water. You snag the gourd with your elbow and pick from the food pile a dried orange, a stick of dry bean curd that Yika's been soaking with some mushrooms in a shallow pan, and a small slab of saltfish. It's not exactly a meal, but it's nutrition. On the bed, you say, gesturing with your chin and bringing the food to her. You hand her the gourd first. Yika, who has observed all this in increasing irritation, snaps.
You're not my type. Is this why you dragged me here?
Not exactly, but while you're here, you need to rest. She looks mutinous. You can't convince anyone of anything, let alone people whose hate can't be reasoned with, if you're too exhausted to think straight. She grumbles, but it is a measure of how tired she is that she actually goes to the bed and sits down on its edge. You nod at the gourd and she dutifully drinks, three quick swallows and down for now, as the lorists advise after dehydration.
I stink. I need a bath.
Should have thought of that before you decided to try to talk down a brewing lynch mob. You take the gourd and push the dish of food into her hand. She sighs and starts grimly chewing.
They're not going to...
She doesn't get far into that lie, though, before she flinches and stares at something beyond you. You know before you turn. Hoa.
Okay, no, not in my rusting room.
I told him to meet us here, you say. It's Hoa.
You told it?
Yika swallows hard, stares a moment longer, then finally resumes eating the orange. She chews slowly, her gaze never leaving Hoa.
Got tired of playing the human, then? Not sure why you bothered. You were too weird to pass.
You go over to the wall near the bedroom door and sit down against it on the floor. The runny sack has to come off for this, but you make sure to keep it near to hand. To Yika, you say, you've talked to the other members of your council and half your comm, Still and Raga, and native and newcomer. The perspective you're missing is theirs. You nod at Hoa. Yika blinks, then eyes Hoa with new interest.
I did ask you to sit on my council once. I can't speak for my kind, any more than you can for yours, Hoa says, and I had more important things to do.
You see Yika blink at his voice, and blatantly stare at him. You wave a hand at Hoa wearily. Unlike Yika, you've slept. But it wasn't exactly quality sleep while you sat in a sweltering apartment waiting for a geode to hatch. Speaking what you know will help. And then, prompted by some instinct, you add, please. Because somehow you think he's reticent. His expression hasn't changed. His posture is the one he showed you last, the young man in repose with one hand upraised. He's changed his location, but not his position. Still. The proof of his reticence comes when he says, very well, it's all in the tone. But fine. You can work with reticent. What does the Grey Stone Eater want? Because you're pretty rusting sure, he doesn't really want Kastrima to join some equatorial calm. Human nation-state politics just wouldn't mean much to them, unless it was in service to some other goal. The people of Renanis are his pawns, not the other way around. There are many of us now, Hoa replies. Enough to be called a people in ourselves, and not merely a mistake. At this apparent non sequitur, you exchange a look with Yika, who looks back at you as if to say, he's your mess, not mine. Maybe it's relevant somehow. Yes, you prompt. There are those of my kind who believe this world can safely bear only one people. Oh, evil Earth. This is what Alabaster talked about. How had he described it? Factions in an ancient war? The ones who wanted people neutralized? Like the Stone Eaters themselves, Baster had said. You want to wipe us out, you say. Whisper. Or change us into stone, like what's happening to Alabaster? Not all of us, Hoa says softly. And not all of you. A world of only stone people. The thought of it makes you shiver. You envision falling ash and skeletal trees and creepy statues everywhere. Some of the latter moving. How? They are unstoppable, but until now they've only preyed on each other that you know of. Can they turn all of you into stone like Alabaster? And if they wanted to wipe humankind out, shouldn't they have been able to manage it before now? You shake your head. This world has borne two people for seasons. Three, if you count origins. The stills do. Not all of us are content with that. His voice is very soft now. Such a rare thing. The birth of a new one of our kind. We wear on endlessly, while you rise and spawn and wilt like mushrooms. It's hard not to envy or covet. Yika is shaking her head in confusion. Though her voice holds its usual unflappable attitude, you see a little frown of wonder between her brows. Her mouth pulls to one side, though, as if she cannot help but show at least a little disgust. Fine, she says. So stone eaters used to be us, and now you want to kill us. Why should we trust you? Not stone eaters. Not all of us want the same thing. Some like things as they are. Some even want to make the world better, though not all agree on what that means. Instantly his posture changes, hands out, palms up. Shoulders lifted in a what-can-you-do gesture. We are people. And what do you want, you ask, because he didn't answer Yika's question and you noticed. Those silver irises flick over to you. Stay. You think you see wistfulness in his still face. The same thing I've always wanted, Esun. To help you. Only that. You think not everyone agrees on what help means. Well, this is touching, Yika says. She rubs her tired eyes. But you're not getting to the point.
What does Castrima being destroyed have to do with giving the world one people?
What's this gray man up to?
I don't know.